Okay, we're gathered into groups of three and we're going to do the tapping. Now, that you have more information than when I gave you this originally, that's the first thing to do is to balance on your thigh bones. Really get on them. And whatever way you want, you can use the melting trochanters on the outsides, the sit bones growing down the backs of the legs, and the spine lengthening, that is releasing the tailbone, really letting the weight rest on the two femur heads. Then the person that's going down will have done that and stay on the femur heads as you fold your back. The other thing is, you don't have to, but it's nice to let your spine lengthen in this position. In other words, it doesn't have to be flat, but I would use the image of letting it lengthen. Okay, so we're in groups of three. Decide who goes down first, follow that procedure, and then we'll tap. Now tap lightly over the top of the body. You can tap very firmly at the upper part, but as you get down further, lighter, because that is very sensitive in there. On the buttocks, you can tap harder. The neck and head, of course, very, very light. We'll take the second member now of the group. Get balance on your femur heads and let your spine elongate as you fold the trunk of your body. Okay, let's take the third member of the group. Probably going to get some banging on here, but it's all right. Let me get on the femur head first. Okay, let's finish up this group with a nice flurry here. All right, whatever way you wish, center on your sit bones. You might want to explore the little rock from side to side and even walking on them. And at some point, to balance on the two sit bones, weight evenly on the two, head centered between, fold the trunk of your body onto your thighs. Just let the body rest on the thighs as you do that. And let the knee ends of the femur bones extend or release into length, and think up the front of the spine and down the back for just a moment. Now, last week, we practiced thinking up the front of the spine and down the back. In many instances, one of which was to unfold. Let me give you a little variation on that now. As you unfold in a moment, unfold one vertebra upon the other, that is to stack the vertebra in your image as you unfold and come up to the vertical position. The last thing on the stack will be the head, which you could think of as a small vertebra if you wish. So you unfold at your own timing when you feel right. Stack one vertebra upon the other for the unfolding process. And you can keep going back to the image of the spine getting longer. Now, I said the head was on the top of the pile, and you can let that be in your image if you want a kind of a general image for the head being the top vertebra. But let's look at just how the head articulates with the spine here. There is an attachment of the head on the top vertebra, which is called the atlas. And I'm going to describe the articulation. It's called the lateral-occipital joint. If you look at the underside of the head, that's the occipital bone, and you'll see an opening called a foramen, right where the spine is here. And on either side of the foramen, there are two little projections that are called the occipital condyles. They look like that, actually, on the outside of the foramen there. They come right out of the edges. And those two condyles fit onto the top vertebra, which is called the atlas. And on the top of the atlas, which is a little ring-like vertebra, doesn't have a center in it, it's like a donut, there are two little depressions, which are called facets. So those two condyles fit in the facets, or sockets. That's the coming out of the underside of the head. This is the first vertebra, the atlas. And this gives the head the ability to rock or to flex and extend about an angle of 15 degrees or so, depending upon the individual, without one's having to bend the cervical spine. In other words, flexion can take place at the atlanto-occipital joint. Later you might want to come up and look at the skeleton here. Take a look at that atlas, the top vertebra upon which the skull is resting. Now, what we're going to do in just a moment or so is to practice balancing the head on that vertebra. And as with all the other parts of the body, the task before us is to get familiar with where is that. Well, I just told you, but that's not enough. The experience of where it's at has to be cultivated. So let's look at it from a standpoint of the sagittal plane, the coronal plane, and the vertical level. First, what level is it vertically? Quite often we look at each other and ourselves in mirrors, and we see a chin here, and quite often we take chin level to be where our head attaches to our bodies, just not realizing it. More accurately, the vertical level is ear level. Now, that point that we put our fingers when we did the balloon, head balloon, right behind the jaw, in front of the mastoid processes here, which are what these are called. If you took a line through there, it would run right through the lateral-occipital joint. Exactly through the lateral-occipital joint. Okay, now if you want to think of that as an axis around which the head can rotate, you could take your head and just rotate it around the axis. Just a small movement. Now the center of that line is the center of the lateral-occipital joint. Okay, now we're going to do a little bit of comparative kinesthetics, that is, where you've established kinesthesia in one part of your body, we're going to see if we can transfer it to the other part. And we'll do that by using the same technique that we used for getting a sense of the weight resting on the femur heads. And we couldn't palpate the iliofemoral joints, but we could palpate the great trochanters where we didn't want to be thinking of support, and we let them melt down the sides of the legs. We're going to do the same thing up here in principle. We don't want to be out here with our concept of support, because again, that would activate muscles here, overactivate them around the jaw and base of the skull. We do want to be at the lateral-occipital joint, which you cannot actually palpate the articulating surface of, although you can touch the atlas from behind here with some difficulty. So, what we're going to do is we touch in here, we're going to watch the mastoid processes in the back of the jaw melting down the sides of the neck and arms and shoulders, as we think of the spine as a supporting column in between, just as the two legs were a supporting column, or two supporting columns in between the melting trochanters. Here you have only one column between the two melting areas here. So if you want to just touch that for a moment, you can do that. Think of the mastoid processes in the back of the jaw just melting downward. And that is a very, very powerful image for centering the head in the coronal plane. We've taken the vertical level, and then by taking the center of the horizontal axis, we've taken the coronal plane, letting these melt down the sides of the neck and shoulders. Will help to get a sense of the centering of the head in this plane. It also is marvelous in conjunction with the widening image, which we do of the head balloon, to release a lot of the tension around the temporomandibular joint around here, and let's say even around the base of the skull. Now, another way to get into that and to use more comparative kinesthetics is to think of the little condyles that I describe, which are resting on the atlas, as being like little sit bones, so that you let the head just sit on top of the spine, again balanced the way you balance on your sit bones. Why don't we review that for a moment, sitting on the sit bones, because we just did that a few minutes ago and you'll be familiar with it. So as you balance on your sit bones, you could think of the retrocanters melting down the sides of your legs, if you like, even as you sit. I'm going to do it in this position too, because the weight, since the sit bones are pretty much in alignment with the in the same plane, the same coronal plane as the acetabula, then you can let the great trochanters melt on the outside of the sit bones. Right there, you see, do that. And so now to do more of the comparison, you put your fingers again in the crevice between the mastoid process and the back of the jaw. As you let these melt, let the head sit on its little sit bones, its condyles of the occiput, which is resting between the two melting points here. Rock the head a little just to get a sense of that. And melting down the sides of the neck and shoulders. Let's look at the sagittal plane for a moment now. This plane going front to back, and you can see on the skeleton, you can see on the chart, head, as we mentioned when we took up levers, is a first-class lever. And its action in the sagittal plane is a first-class leverage action. That is to say, the fulcrum is the spine, where we've just been working at the atlanto-occipital joint. And it seesaws. What I want to point out to you is that in the sagittal plane, the fulcrum is closer to center than we generally think. So many of us think of the head as a hinge joint. That is to say, we think of the head hinged back here instead of this kind of imagery, where it's fulcrum is more nearly under center, not exactly, but closer than you think. If this is our concept of head structure, we tend to tighten back here and fix the head on the muscles back at the base of the skull. If, on the other hand, we can transfer our thinking to the head being balanced like a seesaw, That's why I said the head would assume the rhythm of the body when you walk, when you move, not to be held rigidly against your body rhythm. Then we'll be more likely to be free around the base of the skull instead of rigid, tight, fixed. We can get a sense of that line by touching some bony landmarks. This will work for most skulls, although not every single one. Under the cheekbone, that cheekbone level, the nose at about that level. In other words, I don't take the nose up here above the cheekbone, but I touch it lower part below the cheekbone. Then I go to the occipital ridge here, this ridge you can feel in the back of your head, and I touch that. And I think of a line between the two points. And midway in that line is where your head is centered in the sagittal plane. That's the fulcrum of the seesaw. It's just a means of getting a sense of the line of the head in the sagittal plane. And then you might want to just practice letting the head seesaw, just nod back and forth like a neat little seesaw. Now, I feel necessary to say that again, that I'm multi-leveling the classes. This is not the way I would teach a class that I'm going to have for, say, a semester of basic work. Because there's so much, before you get through this class, so much in it. There's no way anybody here who has not had this work before can possibly absorb everything you're getting this morning. You couldn't do it. I have trouble when I go home recovering from multi-levels. So let me multi-level a little with this. When you nod, I mean, heavy stuff hasn't come yet. It's coming later. When you nod, for those of you who've worked with me before especially, you want to develop a habit of letting the spine lengthen, particularly as you nod forward, so that the nod forward isn't achieved at pulling up the spine, but rather it's a pull down, if anything. It's an extension of the spine as you nod forward. You want to begin to get that in your consciousness somehow, and I wouldn't do it with voluntary movement, not for this class, although in some instances that's not a bad thing to do. But for here, I really want you to get tuned in. I'm trying to tune you up for voluntary movement rather than to practice the voluntary movement as such. Anyway, as you nod the head forward, let the spine lengthen from below. Then let's come to standing. And we're going to walk around a little bit after we balance on our femur heads. And great trochanters melt down the sides of the legs. Then let the head sit on its fulcrum. And by the way, when you balance on your femur head with your pelvis, the pelvis in that sense is a first-class lever also. The head, first-class lever on the top of the spine. And the mastoid processes in the back of the jaw can melt down the sides. And just
Just a little
nod. As you let the weight flow down the back into a lengthening spine. Okay, now let's walk around a little bit as you let the head be a first-class lever, a free first-class lever on top of the spine. Okay, now stay where you are for just a moment. And let's just balance and bounce a little bit on the femur heads. These are little flexions at the iliofemoral joint. And then maybe you could just let that be reduced to where it's imperceptible. And then an easy rocking of the head on the occipital condyles. That is all nodding. Keep letting the spine get longer and longer as you do that. Let gravity have your arms. Let's come back to the benches and have a seat. As you sit on the sit bones, let's do a little rocking again at the iliofemoral joint, trunk flexion. Then the head at the atlanto-occipital joint. Two are very similar. Each time you rock the trunk of the body forward, which you can do now, spine lengthens. Then you can pause with that. Rock the head each time you flex it forward. Small movement, spine lengthens. Now what you've been doing is using the spine and these little processes I've been taking you through as what we call a compound lever. The spine is made up of the 24 movable vertebrae we took up last week. And each of those movable vertebrae, as any bone, and the body, which has movement possibility, could be considered a simple lever. If, however, you use the spine as a single unit, it then becomes what we call a compound lever. Compound lever meaning made up of a series of simple levers. So while each of the movable vertebrae has the potential for leverage on its own right, we choose not to do that in these particular movements which I've given you. So much of what I've given you is a use of the spine as a compound lever because it is, in most instances, more efficient when you have a heavy task to do, weight bearing, or, generally speaking, for better balance. This is not to say you're never going to bend your spine and that is a bad action. It is not. And certainly the spine should be, I think all the vertebrae should be moved every day to keep the flexibility and the tone of the muscles around the various vertebrae. It's not that you are never going to bend them. But generally speaking, for the upright position, to get that smooth flow of weight, if you remember, through the spinal column, so the spine is close to its central axis, to lift objects, generally speaking, most efficient movements are done using the spine as a compound lever. I'd like for us to practice one more little thing now to bring that to our attention. I've given you the little simple processes we've just done, and we've done those movements. But let's take a hypothetical case. Let's say that we wanted to tie our shoe. Well, I can bend down like this, and instead of hunching my back over, I can fold from the thigh joint. Then if I want to look down more, instead of throwing the neck down like that, I don't have to do that. I can just fold from the lateroccipital joint to look down, and I can tie my shoe. Now, to get a good fold in here, you must be willing to let the knee move forward as far as it wishes to, and the flexion to take place at the knee joint and at the ankle joint, which will help you get a good flexion at the iliofemoral. You won't have to hunch over if you do that. So let's do that little simple. Let's divide into partners. I want a partner to watch you to be sure that the spine is lengthening as you do it. And do it on each with each leg. One leg will be easier than the other. Just have somebody looking at you as you do it so they can tell you. In fact, you can touch at the joint there to show them. Shortening the neck as you go down. That's shortening. You want to think more of it doing that. That's fine. And then if you want to bend down further, bend from here. That's right. That's right. That's it. You bend at the lateroccipital. Very good. Fold from here.
Okay.
Just fold from here. And then if you want to do more, you fold from right there. It's just a 15-degree angle. It's not a lot at the head. Fold. Extend the foot. Okay. That's right. Go down onto the... That's it. That's it. You don't have to do this yet. Let that elongate. Now if you want to turn that down, you do it from there. That's correct. That's
right.
It's one line. One line. One line. Absolutely. One line. Right through there. Get the idea of that?
Yeah.
Okay. That's right, right at the joint. That's it. These bones, the pubic bones, are called rami. R-A-M-I is the plural. R-A-M-U-S, ramus is one. And they come together in what we call the pubic symphysis, which I'd mentioned last week in conjunction with a line of movement from the pubic symphysis to the 12th thoracic vertebra. Here now, to narrow across the front of the pelvis, you could imagine the two rami, those two bones bracing against each other, leaning against each other, or thrusting against each other. Touch the pubic symphysis there, just to get in touch with that. And as you think of the two bones leaning against each other, let the Japanese fan open up in back. Now, if you could come to standing for just a moment, and as you stand, you can let the weight rest on the femur heads in whatever way you do that. You could now translate the standing position support to the two rami bracing against each other to give you support in standing. I use that interchangeably with letting the weight rest on the femur heads. That, again, something that needs to be cultivated. And as I let the two rami rest against each other, I watch the sacrum spreading in back. That is the Japanese fan. And you can go back and forth from the idea of the weight resting on the femur heads to the weight bracing at the pubic symphysis. For instance, as you bounce on your femur heads, you could let that little pulse cause the two rami to thrust against each other. Also with a pulse, keeps the image moving. Okay, make yourself comfortable. That's a very important image, the narrowing across the front of the pelvis. What that does, it helps to activate the muscles that tend to knit the pelvis together in front to support the ligamentous action, maintaining the integrity here of the symphysis. If the muscle action here is lax, that is, if we are widening across here, then the ligaments get a lot of undue stress, particularly the ligament across the top of the pelvis, which is called Poupart's ligament. And when that stretches beyond a certain point, the intestines will come through and you have an inguinal hernia. It's particularly true in males. Very few females get an inguinal hernia, although sometimes they do. So that is something that you want to cultivate, the image of narrowing across the front of the pelvis. I'll have other images for you. That's the basic one, and this morning I'm giving it to you for a very special reason, because in a minute, or in a few minutes, we're going to tie it up with another image. Two rami resting against each other. We'll move on in our marathon now to the rib cage. Let's look at the structure of the rib cage. You see the 12 ribs that form, 12 pairs of ribs that form the rib cage. And they curve, and as they curve sharply toward the spine, as you get almost to the spine, you have what is called the dorsal angle of the ribs. The dorsal angle of the ribs. Costal angle being here. These lateral processes which we talked about when we did the spine, they form the attachment for the ribs, the first attachment as the rib curves toward the spine. And that takes place on the rib at a point called the tubercle. The tubercle being like a little knuckle as the rib turns into the spine. The head of the rib, which is kidney-shaped, continues on to the spine and articulates with the vertebra, the bodies of the vertebra. Except for the first and the last two, that articulation takes place between two vertebrae rather than on the body of just one. There is what is called a demifacet on the underside of the vertebra above the rib and on the top of the vertebra below it. Those two little demifacets, which are, you know, I describe the facets on the top of the atlas as being like little sockets. Well, a demifacet is like a little half socket, like a demi-plié. So the demifacets on the bottom and the top of the two vertebrae with which the rib articulate permit a little space for the head of the rib to articulate with. And so the rib in most of those articulations is articulating with the vertebra above and below it and with the intervertebral disc, which is in between the two vertebrae. In front, the ribs don't articulate directly with the sternum here, this breastbone, but rather with the cartilages which are attached to the sternum. The cartilaginous arrangement that you have here permits for greater expansion possibilities in breathing, which we'll be taking up shortly, so that the rib cage, which expands on the inspiratory aspect of breath, will have more expansion possibility than it would have if it was all bone. These dark pieces of plastic we have here represent the cartilage, which, being softer tissue than bone, decays, and so we don't have that. It doesn't last, so we put plastic in there. Now, the rib cage has both tensile and compression support, which is what we're going to deal with this morning, and what I was referring to when I mentioned that it's a lot of things to be confronting all at once. But we're going to put it all together here, and then we'll try to review it at another lesson so it doesn't get lost. The compression support is afforded the ribs at the spine, that is bone resting against bone, and those rib sockets or articulations that I described. The tensile support is afforded by the muscles, which we described collectively last week as tensile force, and we thought up the front. What I want to do this morning is to take a couple of very specific images for that, although the general images I want to still use. That's really the best way to put it together, but in terms of breaking it down, I want to work with some very specific images. There are muscles that suspend the sternum to which the ribs are attached to the base of the skull. And you get still more support for the rib cage with muscles that attach to the first rib and come into the cervical spine. So we're going to work on some very specific images for that. Before that, I want to backtrack just a bit and clarify the nature of the compression support. A compression support through the ribs is afforded by the spine at each rib level. What happens is the weight is transmitted through each rib to the spine, each on its own level. And that weight, as we learned earlier, is always, as you sit or stand, being transmitted, this is vertical position, down through the spine into the pelvis and standing through the legs and sitting through the sit bones. So we'll want to make note of that, and I have incorporated that in the imagery and the processes we'll be doing lying on the floor. This morning we won't be lying very much in constructive rest, mostly on the sides, because I want the ribs to be accessible. Okay, so coming back to the tensile. The image that I'm going to give you for the support at the manubrium, which is a great part of the tensile support of the rib cage, is to imagine that you have a puppeteer with a string vertical attached to the top of the sternum and manubrium, and that you're just hung from that. I'm not going to work with you on that until after you've had the tactile aid lying down, because it will give you a chance to get a little familiar with the sense of ribs being centered. I'm also going to give you the image at the first rib. We're going to imagine the first rib as you're lying in regular constructive rest, becoming vertical to the floor,